Bilney, reel number 6. Now, could you tell me where you went to after you left Cranwell?
Yes, I went to Royal Naval Air Service Station at Killingholme on the Humber, which is right on the... It's a hutted camp, or was, I should say, a hutted camp, right on the banks of Humber, backing onto the oil tank storage at Immingham. There were one or two sizable hangars, in most of which were Curtiss flying boats, which had just been brought over from America. Big, comparatively big twin-engine boats. The surrounding country was sort of flat and irrigation ditches and thoroughly uninteresting. The Humber itself was just a rather dirty-looking muddy stream with a considerable current, too. Well, I started off flying, converting onto seaplanes there. First of all, on the 150-horse power short seaplane, which is a twin-float seaplane, with a Canton Uné 150 or 200-horse engine. It was a water-cooled radial engine. Quite good, too. But the one trouble with the 150 type seaplane, some of which had sunbeam engines, 12-cylinder V's, was that they had unbalanced aileron. And if you got tail to wind and there was a considerable breeze blowing, the ailerons came down at right angles to the plane, and there you sailed along downwind in an almost powerless position, because you couldn't get up at enough speed very often to pull up the aileron and manage to turn. However, in time, you sort of managed to wangle out of it, but it was very disconcerting at times. But otherwise, there was nothing to fly them at all. They were very much heavier than the land plane. You used a large wheel to heave the thing round the sky. And I suppose you could do a vertical bank on it if you wanted to, but it wouldn't be very comfortable. Generally speaking, they were rather unmanoeuvrable and fairly clumsy affairs, which, as they weighed 2.5 tons, you can quite imagine that they weren't very manoeuvrable. Then from there, I went on to the larger float seaplane, the short 184 type, it was known as, which had various engines, Renault Mercedes 240 horse, Sunbeam 240s, and some of them with the Sunbeam 260 horse engine. But they're all much of a muchness, and nothing very exciting to them.
Hmm. Were there any other characteristics of seaplanes which struck you as being very different from flying aeroplanes?
Oh, yes. The main difficulty always was takeoff in a rough sea, because you were very apt to get, as you gathered speed, to get thrown up in the air by a wave without flying a speed, and you came down mighty whack the other side. And it just depended, if you've got enough control just to catch it and ease it, you're all right, and you hit the top of the next wave and then probably get away. But sometimes you weren't so lucky and you just couldn't get airborne at all. Landing was somewhat similar, but usually you would be pretty well under control, just about stalling speed, when you sat in the water and stay put. And then, of course, these float seaplanes, you had to taxi them up onto a slipway, where the handling crew caught hold of you and put the thing on a trolley, and then it was hauled up into the beach. But if it was a strong side wind, getting onto the slipway wasn't all that easy, because with a big fin area, they always tended to weathercock into wind. So you had to come in with a really strong wind, pretty fast, but not fast enough to remove the undercarriage on the slipway.
What about flying boats? Did they come into your training?
Well, at that time,
stage?
No, because they were just sort of, those flying boats were just coming in operational then, these Curtiss twin-engine boats. And they didn't really... We didn't touch them at all. Mm.
You've told me something about the difference in the mechanics of flying seaplanes and flying aeroplanes, was there any difference in emphasis on the sort of tactical training you received at the time you were increasing your pilot skills?
Well, as regards flying, I would say none. But on the ground, we did do quite a lot of practice shooting at balloons. We did quite a lot of navigational exercises. And we rather increased our elementary knowledge of what the Navy commonly calls bends and hitches, rope work, boat handling, and that type of thing. All the maritime skills.
I was wondering whether the difference in the use of seaplanes on the one hand and aeroplanes on the other was reflected in the kind of training you had.
No, except, as I say, the emphasis was on the seaside, whereas in our elementary land plane training we didn't really do any what you might call operational training at all. On the seaplanes, we were not only learning to fly seaplanes, but we were learning something about the seaside. Oh, also, of course, recognition of ships and submarines. One of the more amusing incidents, or the only bit of excitement I can remember at Killingholme, which was a very dull spot, was one night a Zeppelin came over, and as we were just alongside the oil tanks, it was considerable worry as to what might happen. But the Zepp didn't hit it, drop anything, so we all went to sleep again. That was all right. I wasn't there very long, actually.
Another thing which interests me is that as a naval aviator, doubtless great attention was given to the use of aircraft at sea with the fleet. I wonder how much how big a part this played in your training?
None, because at that time there were in existence two seaplane carriers. That was all. I think I'm right there, indeed. Maybe three. And there were no shipborne aircraft other than those at that time. And the seaplane carriers, after all, you were merely doing the same job under the same conditions, except that you were living and being launched from a ship.
When you left Killingholme, you then qualified as a seaplane pilot.
Yes.
And what was the next phase in your training?
Well, I went to the very much pleasanter spot of Calshot on the Southampton water, where the actual seaplane base and hangars was on the end of the spit, jutting out into Southampton water and surmounted by the old Martello Tower. The offices were the old Coast Guard cottages, which had been converted, and then we had hangars along the foreshore. The camp was about a mile and a half away, which was a hutted camp at Eaglehurst, and we used to go to and fro in a meter gauge light railway, and all meals and so forth were taken up at the camp. And a very pleasant capital station. The commander at the time, I remember, was one of the very earliest aviators in this country, F.E.T. Hewlett, who was taught to fly by his mother at Brooklands in, goodness knows where, 99 or something of the sort. And there I did mainly armament training. I did a little bit more flying on short seaplanes myself. But we had a bombing range out in the Solent, the target, and we used to go over and drop these little smoke bombs and learn the technique of bombing and trying to hit a target. And also we had a firing target out there, which we used to stand up in the back seat with the Lewis gun and poop off a few shots and see the splash.
Could you describe some of the exercises you did when you were training in bomb dropping?
Oh, yes. What you had to do, what was known as a drift sight in those days, which was tied onto the side, bolted onto the side of the aircraft, You had to fly with the drift bar fore and aft until such time as you got no drift, which meant that you were going upwind or downwind, as the case may be, but you could assess which it was, usually from looking at the sea, because the white horses always tell you which way the wind is. And then, having established that, you then turned at right angles to port to drift over any given object which happened to be in sight, and thereby measure your degree of drift. And having set your drift bar to that position, you were then, having previously set your altitude and speed, airspeed, you were then positioned to go up to the target upwind, and you should be able to get a reasonable shot. Very simple.
Yeah.
But not very accurate.
I was going to say, what was your impression of the accuracy which you were able to achieve?
Oh, pretty poor. I couldn't say what it is now, because, anyway, it wasn't very accurate.
Mm.
But it remained very much the same until fairly recent years. Really, until these electronic aids came in and the what's known as the automatic bomb sight.
Mm. I thought perhaps that the much slower speeds at which the aircraft moved in those days would have compensated for the lack of efficiency of the,
yes,
bomb aiming.
That's true. Well, that really only hopes to fall after. You still, it's this accurate assessment of your wind speed and its direction, which is the difficulty. That with any manual form, form of bomb sight is not very easy.
What was your attitude to your bombing skills when you'd finished this course? I mean, did you feel that your work would be operationally effective with the level of competence you'd managed to achieve?
Well, I should think I rather doubted it, but in any case, as a pilot, you see, I shouldn't be doing the bombing, bomb sighting, it'd be the chap in the back seat. But obviously I should have had experience of the job in order to know how to fly the aeroplane to best suit his convenience. But there's quite a technique in flying for bombing. You've got to keep absolutely dead straight, steady course and steady speed. Otherwise you wreck the whole outfit.
I was really driving at the value, which the military value which you would attribute to bombing. I mean, at the time you were doing it, did you enter it with a slight sort of scepticism about what you were doing?
Well, as a comparatively small boy at the time, I don't think I really thought very much about military values. Would you have done?
Well, maybe not in sort of strategic terms, but you know, whether I could sink the damn submarine if I hit it is something which
I'd have certainly tried damn hard, but I don't think I'd ever really thought as to what sort of hope of hitting it we would have. It obviously, you know, if we were low down, say 500 feet, we might have had a reasonable shot. I think you've probably done at that height probably just as well without a bomb sight if it comes to that. But as I say, being young and enthusiastic, I don't think it worried me very much at that time. I made a mistake in saying that we lived at Eaglehurst Camp. That, in fact, was not completed until, I think, after the war. And at the time in question, we, in fact, lived at Hamble, where, alongside the group headquarters of No. 10 Group, and we used to go to and fro from Calshot in a motorboat. Okay.
Now, at this stage, by the beginning of 1917, you finish your training and were ready for your first posting to an operational station.
Yes.
Where did you get sent to?
I went to a horrible place called South Shields. And it was a small seaplane station with, I think there were three, maybe four pilots, and the CO, who was a pilot but never flew as far as I know. And our job was mainly the escorting of coastal convoys between the Farne Islands and the Tees. The actual station was situated on the Heard Sands in the harbour at the entrance to the Tyne, and we had a steel hangar, corrugated hangar, slipway, and offices there, and some workshops. The harbour was generally too small for us to take off in. If there was a strong wind, sometimes we could just scramble over the seawall. It was a harbour with two seawalls. So mostly we had to go outside to try and get off the water, and that was usually pretty rough. The amenities of South Shields were, completely nicks. It's shipbuilding, heavy industry and mining district, a filthy town. The officers lived in a little hotel, billeted in a, which we ran ourselves as well. Yes, we did, we ran ourselves. And there was nothing to do in the evening, so on the main we used to run a poker or a champagne pool or something of that sort to keep ourselves out of mischief.